Tonight on The Download, our resident philosopher, Al Genie. From The Daily Line, Heather Sharone, A.D. Quigg, and Ray Hodge. And our royal correspondent, Fred Weintraub. Now, here's your host, a man who hopes the royal wedding has an open bar, Justin Kaufman.
Soaking up all that beef eater.
All right, what's the London's gin? Is that just...
We have a ton of London's gin?
At the royal wedding? I wonder how that works. They have little shrimps that go around in the beforehand and the reception, all that kind of stuff. Is there a point where they tell the... They tell Prince William, Prince Charles, hey, it's too much, guys. Cut you off. It's one too many Chardonnays. Knock it off. Chicken dance, that kind of stuff. I don't know. Find out. We're going to talk about the royal wedding tonight. Hey, everybody. Justin Kaufman here on The Download. With you till 11 o'clock. 720 WGN. We got a great show. I'm not a big royal wedding kind of guy. I don't know much about him. Pete just kind of looked at me side-eyed when I actually said out loud, well, we didn't really cover the last one with what's his name? And Prince something? I don't know why. It's not unlike our pop culture news here in America. Sometimes it just kind of goes over my head and I don't pay attention. But Fred Weintraub, who is a longtime Chicago journalist, worked over at WCIU, continues to do stuff there, moved to London, and he's become the correspondent. He has a great piece in the Daily Herald today, or yesterday, about the fact that, hey, I thought this was pretty shallow. I thought these were the UK Kardashians. And now that I'm covering them more and understanding the fascination and what they do for the community, it's a whole different story. So we'll talk to Fred about the royals coming up tonight here on The Download. Also, talk about our own royal families, politicians, because that would be it here. We got a lot of stories to talk about. City, state, county. Lots going on today. Wow. You know it's a big news day in politics when we have to get all three of the women at the Daily Line on the show. Ray Hodge is going to join us from Springfield, Heather Sharone and A.D. Quigg, all covering different stories, important stories. They'll be on at 7:30 tonight. Interesting day in Springfield after yesterday, the bombshell that the governor dropped saying that he wanted to bring back the death penalty. And then there is progression, there is movement in the gun store licensing compromise that Senator Harmon had put in. I think it's cleared the Senate. So that's something that we'll be paying attention to and talking to Ray about coming up here at 7:30. 8 o'clock tonight, Al Genie's back. The resident philosopher joins us every month. We postponed last month because it was one of the games where the Sox went extra innings. And we just ran out of time, and I sent Al home. But we were going to talk about the great men theory. Men, women, but the actual name is the great men theory. This idea that... can you be a great leader if you're not a great man? This was the there's a Thomas Carlyle quote from a 19th century philosopher. Yeah, no big deal. I know all about 19th century philosophy, or I just read about it today. Essentially about that heroes, we know this same, that history is written by heroes. And the question becomes, is do we have to kind of think the way that we approach history and writing it from the hero's standpoint, especially when it's all kind of based on this idea of this great men make great leaders, but then you have situations that many are in today and have seen in modern history. And I'm not talking specifically about President Trump. I'm talking about more tyrants like Adolf Hitler, of course, and others that come to mind where they fit the theory. They are the prototype for the great man theory. But they went awry. So what does it take to be a great leader? We'll talk leadership coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Also, we're going to talk race tonight. Professor Matthew Shinoda from the from Columbia College has a whole anti-racism workshop. We'll talk to him about that in the wake of some of the things that have been happening along race relations here in this country in the last couple of weeks. And, of course, Greg Flamm in the swap meet. Giving away pizza for the best brag. 312-981-7200. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Just wanted to update the listeners because 708 said I missed yesterday's show because we didn't go on until 10 o'clock. How's my grandma? I mentioned that we went up to see my grandma on Monday, and she, and thanks to all the well wishes, everybody, but she passed away yesterday. And it's a sad day, but she lived a great life, and we had talked about it on the show that she was suffering from Alzheimer's dementia. And she had kind of been in the throes of it. She was in the late stages of it. And, you know, I didn't really plan to talk about it. It kind of came out right at the top of the show. And the response, the overwhelming response, the text that came in afterwards about connection and the fact that so many people out there who are listening to WGN Radio, who have lost a loved one, a parent or grandparent, have lost them to Alzheimer's and dementia. This is something, of course, there's the run that's coming up. I think we're advertising it, but this is something that affects not just random people. It seems to affect a majority of people as people get older. So she lived a great life, and I am forever grateful that I got a chance to go up on her last day and visit with her. And as I said on Monday, she had a room full of pictures, photos, and memories. And the irony wasn't lost on me that a woman who had made all these great memories no longer had the capacity to remember them. And those pictures on their own wouldn't actually have any sort of introspective moment for me. If I saw the picture of me at 6 years old next to my grandma and then Mickey Mouse, I would be like, oh, that picture, that memory. Or another picture of when I was 12, or when I was 15 or 16 in Arizona trying to grow a beard. It's my favorite, where kind of, you know, the picture with grandma and I'm a little bit cooler with my horn-rim glasses. None of that stuff matters, except it all matters now. You know, just in the way that now I feel like I'm the custodian of those memories. And she passes on and, you know, didn't have the capacity to remember those. It's on me. And it all means something. And each memory that you see and each memory that comes out of that picture, so many stories in the last day have kind of bubbled up to the forefront that I wouldn't have thought about otherwise. And that's, of course, what you do when someone dies. But it's tremendous, and I feel like, you know, it's a tremendous honor and a tremendous moment for me to be the custodian of those memories, and I'll keep them in my heart forever. Let's put it that way. And anyone who has been in a situation where you've lost someone to Alzheimer's or dementia, you know exactly what I'm talking about. News, weather, and traffic tonight with the greatest team in the land, Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by the maestro, Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and do the carryouts. Stay with us. It's a Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here today's top story is a financial disclosure disclosed that the president did pay his lawyer, Michael Cohen, sums that would be in line with a hush money payout to Stormy Daniels. This would make the president's earlier on-the-record statements false. So, another word for false, lie, right, sorry. But I guess we're cool with that from our presidents now. The interesting story here is that this disclosure was mandatory, so the Trump team knew it would be coming out. So the Giuliani gaffe a couple weeks back on Hannity, remember that? Doesn't seem so gaffy anymore. So from here on out, mainstream media, maybe stop making all these players out to be dum-dums who just can't get out of their own way. They're playing you. And us, but mostly you. The mayor in Chicago is mad at anti-Obama library folks who put forth a lawsuit to stop the new presidential center in Jackson Park because it's not what was advertised. It's not honoring the park as much as they said they would, instead building over the park. The mayor called the lawsuit frivolous and that the group needs to come live in the 21st century. What does that mean? They drive around horse and buggy? I don't understand. I will say that the big difference was that the Obama Foundation said they were going to honor the park in their original proposal. That changed. So what makes them just get to take Jackson Park and build private buildings, right? What makes it different than the Lucas Museum fiasco? Why not build a few buildings in an abandoned train lot and add some green space? And can you answer why the mayor continues to push projects on parkland when it's obvious that the old decree has merit saying that the parkland should not be messed with? That's there for Chicago protection. Chicago's protection. And if you say it's because you want to bring economic opportunity to the south side of Chicago, there are plenty of places in which, by all means, you could build that isn't protected park space. The reason the mayor's mad is because he knows he's in trouble if this doesn't go through. First Lucas, then Obama? That's on you, bud. But the Sun-Times, which nobody asked, but Sun-Times is saying that the project should go ahead. You know, the paper of the people. Cool. He saw the hubbub about the Cook County Hospitals putzing away over $150 million. How'd they do it? The inspector general says it's because the clerks and the office workers aren't trained nor invested in their jobs. Have you been to paperwork hell? That's what I call the hospital checkout process. Find me one person who's excited about that job. You want a better hospital story? A suburban hospital is being sued for not protecting patient data as an ex-employee is accused of burglarizing homes when people are in the hospital. What? That's nightmare stuff, right? How is that not the headline scrawl on all news everywhere? I mean, that's biggest fear territory, right? That's right behind bugs crawling in your ears when you sleep, right? That's crazy. What a crazy story. It just kind of gets blurbed. Blurb. In weather, kind of the best day yet, don't you think? Great day. Warm, but not. Sleeves optional. Sunny. No volcanic eruptions. I take it. In sports, the White Sox played super early today. Nothing like baseball before lunch. Well, the result was the same. The Sox lost to the Pirates. They've lost 13 of their last 15. Now at 10-29, they've matched their worst start since 1948. Sox fans, let's breathe. This is just a montage in the natural or major league. You know, the losing is a disease montage that leads up to the moment where lightning strikes, Makata's bat, or Corbin Burnson saves the team. I'm getting the movies mixed up. That's all coming up. Just shut your eyes, listen to the old-timey music, and think about all the April and May. All of this right now is just losing is a disease. And then come June and July, this music will turn into something more stringy. We'll lose the big trumpets and Dixieland brass. Right now we're in the middle of that losing is a disease montage. So just let it play. All right, good. We good? That montage is over. Hobbs, get a bat. Let's see what you can do. Jimenez, get a bat. Let's see what you can do. Right? We're on our way. Cubs are playing in Atlanta. Is Yu Darvish okay? He pitched well last night, but he was removed with leg cramps. It's all about the fifth inning for him. That's usually when he breaks bad. He avoided it last night, but he's... is he just going to come up with a bunch of weird ailments to avoid the fifth inning every time out? Is that what we're going to see here? The Bulls played one of their lousiest seasons to date, effectively admitting they tanked the season away for a high draft pick. They were losers last night in the Latin draft lottery. The Bulls actually lost a spot and ended up with the seventh overall pick, which after the Butler trade is exactly where they were last year. So all of that losing, non-competitive losing, to get the seventh overall. You know what I'd do? I'd go get DeMar DeRozan out of Toronto. He was benched at the end of last round's playoff matchup with LeBron. He's got to be angry about that. Give the Raptors the seventh and then play eeny, meeny, miny, moe with the rest of the roster and give them whoever they want. DeRozan is a proven all-star scorer, a leader, and he's mentioned in rap songs. And if you know me well, that's all I want on my basketball team. Players mentioned in rap songs. There we go. Tonight, Rockets and Warrior game two. There's like nine guys in there that are mentioned in rap songs. Funny story out of New York. Actor Ethan Hawke said that the Knicks owner took away his tickets after he criticized the team. No soup for you. It's the Knicks. What are you supposed to do, lie? I guess that's a New York thing. All right. And finally tonight, police investigated suspicious luggage today at Ogilvie train station. It turned out it wasn't luggage. It was just an extra train car. And everyone was so amazed that the trains were at full strength that they thought it must be a trick. I'd inspect that car, too. If not mysterious, it's completely abnormal. So... that's the carryout for May 16, 2018. Hey, why cook a whole meal when you could just carry out? Someone just sent text, is like, 21st century is not horse and buggy. I'm like, oh, I guess you're right. I got the 19th century philosophy in my head. Coming up, the Daily Line joins us. Ray Hodge, Heather Sharon, and A.D. Quigg. We got a lot to talk about, so we'll get to it right after the news. It's a download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. It's Wednesday night, so it's time for the Daily Line. Adi Quigg is in studio. Hi, Adi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Heather Sharone's going to join us on the line. Ray Hodge as well from Springfield. Excited to talk today. A lot going on. Why don't we start with Springfield and bring Ray Hodge. And Ray, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Of course, we do this every Wednesday night, the Daily Line. You can find them at dailyline.net. Lots to talk about. We get right into Springfield. Of course, yesterday, the big bombshell news that the amendatory veto that the governor put forth on gun control measures, he proposed bringing back the death penalty. That, of course, had reverberations throughout Springfield and the state of Illinois and the country. But before we get to that, let's talk about what's been happening with the gun shop bill. Senator Harmon putting that through today. It's actually moving as we speak. Talk about what this is and what makes it different than what it was before.
Right. So the last time we left off with this bill, it had seen an attempt to get an override of the governor's veto, who called it too burdensome, a set of restrictions on gun dealers. There was a lot of pushback, not only from the NRA, but from gun proponents themselves. People flooded the lobbies of the Capitol to protest this. Flash forward to today, flash forward to yesterday, when you see Senator Don Harmon, the initial sponsor of that gun dealer licensing bill, rolling out a brand new bill. Similar to the gun dealer licensing bill, this too would require some more restrictions, some more cautious, careful implementation and data tracking by gun dealers, both large and small. But in a different way, it wouldn't require necessarily a gun dealer to have an altogether new state license. Rather, they would just take the federal gun dealer license that they've already got to have, and they would just take it to the Illinois State Police, register it with them, and make sure that the state is able to give them a certification. There's still going to be a little bit of costs associated with that to run the program, but it is proponents both on the GOP side and the Dem side are saying that this is a great way to cut red tape, to address some of the concerns of the retailers, and to try and meet halfway on some of these measures to get something out of the legislature.
Yeah, and that's the question. I mean, is it enough of a compromise to get the governor to sign it if it gets through? I'm really kind of pushing towards what the governor said the problem was in the first place. It was too much regulation, too much red tape. If this takes this away, do you see the governor saying, this is what I asked for, sign, sign, sign?
Well, it did pass out of the Senate today with a 35-18 vote. Now, you would hope that if you're looking for something, a sweeping bipartisan vote, you would hope to see a little bit of a better number with that. But we did see three Republicans breaking ranks to join with this. Of course, there's also, Chris Nybo, who rolled out this bill with Harmon, who was really rallying for GOP support. You still do see some more of the conservatives saying that. You have, for example, Senator Dale Ryder from Mattoon, a Republican who is a very reliably conservative voter, and he was saying as well, still too restrictive on gun dealers, still too restrictive on gun owners. He likened it to if you are charging a automaker or an auto dealer with the crimes of someone who has taken a car and wrecked it. Mm. However, there was some pushback back and forth on the floor about that, especially given the lack of information overall that we have about gun dealers and their exact role in the process of gun crime. And one of the components of this bill that was actually very favored by Republicans, including conservatives like Ryder, was the fact that there's a provision in here that would require gun dealers to keep good track records on what they're selling and how they're selling it.
Yeah, that's and obviously yesterday the bill or the amendatory veto that came forward about the 72-hour waiting period, that brought guns back into the forefront and added to it this measure to bring back the death penalty in some severe cases, mass murder or shooting of or murder of a police officer. How has that played out in Springfield today? Leaders have been talking to the press about it. Obviously, that was called out quickly by the newspapers and a lot of the media in town as a political ploy for elections. But how are the different lawmakers in Springfield reacting to that?
Well, you know, on one hand, you've got, you know, Attorney General candidate and Democrat from Chicago, Senator Kwame Raoul, who, you know, called it a quote-unquote stupid diversion. You had Senator Don Harmon at his press conference for this new gun shop bill yesterday, calling it not an amendatory veto, but a veto. So you've got some Democrat sentiment here, as well as, you know, from other members, that it's kind of perceived as a non-starter, and reasonably so, given that, you know, it was in 2011. After enormous controversy, that the death penalty was finally repealed. So it seemed from the outset that, you know, if you've got 17 of your 20-something legislative leaders that are relatively opposed, and pretty wide number of Republicans as well opposed to the death penalty, it seemed almost right away, not only by Democrats but by ground-level Republicans as well, to be a non-starter in the conversation. That said, what are you going to do when you're going to roll out, you know, what kind of position are you really in? If you're a GOP governor who's narrowly secured a victory in a primary against a much more conservative opponent, Representative Jeannie Ives, you know, maybe you've underestimated her a little bit, and then you've got to really secure up that conservative base. So when you're rolling out these mandatory vetoes, you look at the other ones, it's kind of the AV is more or less of two minds here. You've got an expansion. Not only does the 72-hour cool-down period apply to just assault weapons, Rahner wants it on all weapons. On top of that, you've got a ban on bump stocks and trigger cranks, itself generating a lot of controversy at the time. And then on top of that, you've got, you know, emergency restraining orders that can be applied by judges for people who are demonstrably at risk to themselves and others. So there's a lot of concessions here towards Democrats. You've really got to throw the base something that they can get their hands around. Death penalty support might just be that thing.
Well, also the leadership, of course, the big Illinois chair vote was coming up, this, or the big summit this weekend, and they already said that they came to a conclusion that Schneider and Shaw will come together and co-run the Illinois State Party. This seemed to be the Republicans. This seemed to be that olive branch, that idea that both parts, wings of the Republican Party, the more moderate and the conservative, are coming together to support the Republican agenda this general election.
Right. And so that's like the second step we've seen this week from Rahner coming into his election season, really, you know, trying to bring together two sides of this. You've got, you know, you've got to make sure that those suburban swing districts that are, you know, relatively, even among the Republicans there, they are relatively pro-gun control, strongly in some places. And then you've got, you know, the other half of the state that is, you know, still very deeply conservative. So you see not only that in his AVs, but you see this in the concession towards the party leadership overall.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of a interesting thing when you look at how the grassroots have impacted this, not only as a shift in policy, not only as it's related to the gun control issues which have come up, but also even in the party co-chairman's, you know, Mark Shaw, his sort of title is conservative and grassroots outreach. That really looks like a big Band-Aid, and it kind of, you know, it kind of has to be at this stage in the game.
Ray Hodge covers Springfield for the Daily Line, and I want to thank you for joining us, Ray. Thank you, and we will talk soon. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Have a nice one.
Yep. All right, so we got Springfield out of the way. A.D. Quigg and Heather Sherrone. Heather's on the line as well. We'll take a quick break, come back, and let's get into some of the county issues, the Cook County Hospital, of course, and the lawsuits against the Obama Foundation and the Presidential Center that's proposed in Jackson Park, and also police, of course, a big meeting down, where was it, Roseland? It was in Roseland, where it kind of got off the rails when talking about police accountability, and we'll talk more about that. The Daily Line is here. It's a download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Heather Sherrone is on the line with us. Also, A.D. Quigg in studio, thedailyline.net. You can follow all their stuff. Why don't we start with you quickly, A.D., the story that earlier this week grabbed everybody's attention, the Cook County Hospital system is missing, mismanaged. I don't know what the right word is, $175 million. You've been reporting on this. Nobody paid attention.
Yeah. We're a small publication. So a couple months ago, the Cook County IG came out with a report that said Cook County Hospital, which has largely run charity care for years and years and years, which just became a private insurer in addition to offering charity care, has been misbilling people for several years. And that essentially left $175 million on the table.
Mm.
They've gotten better at it since then, but $175 million is a ton for them when they are facing budget shortfalls every single year.
Absolutely, and that's the major reason for a Cook County budget at all.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I it's such an interesting story, too, because the way it was positioned yesterday was, it's missing. This idea I heard a couple times where they're like, what did they do with $175 right. million? But it's really about how they bill.
It's about
they've been
coding and scheduling, and mistakes happen at several steps, but at each step you're missing out on $10 million here, $20 million there. So it's a big deal.
Heather Sharone is on the line. Heather, let's talk about the Civilian Accountability Police meeting. Was that a meeting, the voluntary meeting that was run by, was it Alderman Raboris down in Roseland? You covered it. It, of course, had a lot of fireworks and protests and interruptions. What was the whole idea behind this meeting and what happened?
Well, it was at Corliss High School, and the issue is that the council has four proposals for a new way to hold police officers who are accused of misconduct accountable. Now, two of the proposals are much tougher than the other two, and the other two were proposed by Alderman Raboris, who held the meeting, which was originally designed to be sort of a touchy-feely, let's all talk about our feelings type meeting.
Love those kind of meetings.
The crowd was just not having it, and it had been going for all of about 10 minutes when people just were outraged that there weren't people there who could detail the difference in the proposals, and the proposals are very different. Some of them would give this oversight board the ability to hire and fire the superintendent and be completely independent from the city council and the mayor. Others would work more closely with the mayor and the city council. So there are a lot of, you know, sort of things to discuss. So this meeting just erupted, and, you know, like, every meeting like this, there were, you know, big pieces of paper and markers for people to write things down. And quickly, those pieces of papers turned into protest signs with people writing, "We object to this process." And even though the meeting was supposed to go for 2 hours, it barely got underway and it barely lasted an hour. And I spoke with Alderman Raboris today, who said that he is meeting with other aldermen to figure out what the format should be for the next meetings going forward. There are four more left. He acknowledged that what happened last night was a mess and that they need to rethink some things.
I will say this is interesting because, as we talked about in this segment last week, you've got someone pushing the mayor from the left and someone pushing the mayor from the right when it comes to policing in the city. These kind of meetings that grab the headlines and get the media's attention because of their the way they fall apart, that's just not a good look.
No, and what I thought was interesting was that there were people there who were very, very angry. And these are people who, you know, had personal, you know, interactions with the police that they found troubling or inappropriate. And this was not sort of an academic exercise to them. This was really the life or death of their community. And that's was not how the meeting was structured, and I think that caught some of the aldermen who were there off guard.
Right, and this is interesting because there are three different bad headlines coming out for the mayor saying, we've got this botched meeting, we've got Paul Vallis pressuring you on the FOP contract and police hiring, and we have these separate groups calling for a consent decree to come out already because it's been, you know, 9 months of negotiations.
Yeah, right.
So the police accountability thing is really at the forefront of the mayoral campaign already.
And the last thing we'll talk about, which also has the mayor's attention and eye and is drawing his ire, is the a lawsuit that was put forth into the courts from a not-for-profit parks group that is saying that the Obama Presidential Center and Library that's in Jackson Park, the proposal is not what they said it was going to be, and therefore it violates the old decree about using park space. This is one that the mayor came out quickly and said, he called it
get
frivolous.
Get the heck out of here.
Get the heck out of here. He said, it's time to start living in the 21st century.
Right.
You know, but there is something to be said. We've seen this fight play out in Chicago before, and it hasn't broke towards the city's mayors.
Right.
So you can understand why he's wanting to control this narrative.
Yes. The most recent thing about this was the Lucas Museum, and this was a private person using public park space that was supposed to be protected along the lakefront, and people got so mad that George Lucas said, screw it, I'm going out to California.
Right.
This time it is Chicago's golden boy, Barack Obama, who wants to use this parkland for his private foundation. So what is going to happen tomorrow is the Plan Commission is going to hold a vote on the park district selling this piece of land to the city, and the city will hold a ground lease and give that to the Obama Foundation for probably a nominal fee, a dollar usually.
Right.
And they'll be able to operate this museum in perpetuity at Jackson Park, which is right on the lakefront. And so many issues have emerged because of this. Displacement, people worried that rising property values around Jackson Park will push them out, that the jobs that will be created there will not be for them, that it's closing a major roadway for the South Side, and that Obama has ignored community demands to sign a community benefits agreement.
And it is interesting because in this case, this is a Chicagoan. With George Lucas, there was arguments about giving it to a rich guy to do a Star Wars museum on a lakefront.
Right.
But this is the former president of the United States. They made the determination to have this library presidential center in Chicago. If you can't, you know, do the deal to take parkland from the city as a former president, you can't do the deal.
Right.
I mean, this is it, right?
And what'll happen tomorrow is we have not seen a ton of pushback from a lot of aldermen. And this is just the Plan Commission, which is a mayoral appointed board. The mayor has said this will benefit Jackson Park. This will add, you know, $500 million in construction jobs and billions in economic investment down the line. I expect there to be protests at the Plan Commission, but this thing will probably still sail through. And then it'll go on to the Zoning Committee, and I think there will be protests.
And that's all outside of what's happening in the courts.
Correct.
Right. A.D. Quigg, Heather Sharon, also Ray Hodge, who joined us a little bit earlier. The Daily Line joins us every Wednesday here on The Download. I can't thank you guys enough for... And this is fun. I like the three. We went fast through all these issues.
Boom.
So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk royal wedding. You can stick around for that, Al, if you want.
I brought my tiara, so I'm all ready.
You're all ready to go. Well, it's time for our monthly visit from our resident philosopher, Al Genie. Tonight, let's talk about the great man theory. It's based on the philosophy of the 19th century thinker named Thomas Carlyle, who said that the history of the world is but the biography of great men. Essentially, heroes shape history. And the conversation tonight is about the great modern man and whether or not Carlyle's theory holds water. Do you have to be a great man to be a great leader? This theory plays out well for leaders like FDR or Winston Churchill. But what happens when the great man theory goes sideways? A leader, say someone like the biggest monster in human history, Adolf Hitler, has the traits aligned with the great man theory. Is he a great man? Is he a great leader? Our resident Download philosopher Al Genie is here tonight. Al's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. He joins us monthly here on the program. Al, great to see you, man.
Always wonderful to be here. And you know, you hit it right on the head. The great man theory, in some sense, is an idea that comes in and out, and is it really important, and is it somewhat passé? And certainly the title itself is passé.
Yeah.
It's a great person theory.
Right.
But the reality is the great leaders of history have been predominantly men, except for a few real exceptions.
We can change in our heads. We'll just say, whenever we say the great man theory,
we mean man as group, right.
Yeah. Man slash woman.
Right, right. And given that this year's Academy Awards and Gary Odom and The Darkest Hour, which is a really fantastic performance, to be assured, and given the political posturing going on around us as we speak with regard to Russia, North Korea, and China, and the nationalism that's reoccurring in Poland and Hungary and Italy, with leaders who are trying to take over in a kind of despotic manner, I think it's time to relook at this notion of what we mean by great leader. And we're not even mentioning our president.
Well, we'll mention him as well, I mean, because he fits into this mold.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you wonder how much. And before we get into the posturing about the actual current events and how it's the leaders of today. Let's talk about this theory.
Yeah.
What is the theory? What is the great man theory? Where does it come from? Who's Thomas Carlyle? Research for me. Google.
I'm Google Genie. That's a wonderful way to look at it. You know, he's a 19th century great commentator, and he is an historian, a great thinker, and a philosopher. It depends what cap he is wearing at the time. And he talked about the notion that the history of the world is about the biography of great men. And that great men, not great movements, not demographics, not economic forces, change the course of history. And what a man has accomplished in the world is the sum total of the history of the world. And that's how we look at the world. And what's special about these great men is, his theory, comes out of the fact that these guys are winners. And they're because they come to reality because there's a crisis, not simply an existential crisis, but rather a crisis that can change the course, the pattern, the structure of a society, of a country, of a nation, of a world. And so the great men theory comes in that individuals come in and disrupt that, change that, resolve that, rehabilitate that, reform that, redefine that in a way that the crises fits their talents, their capacity, and their character, and they're the right person at the right time. So what's really important about this is, in some very real sense, that the great man theory is a crisis-specific kind of ability. You can be a great man at the wrong time in the wrong place, and you're Joe Schmo from Idaho, okay? The reality is, the right person at the right time, and the example we're going to get to, I don't want to get too much away from it, is Winston Churchill.
Well, let's go right there, because it's so interesting to think about it. When you really put your thinking cap on, you think about different movements, history, history book, and you're absolutely right that it's not necessarily about the movements, it's about the people who exemplify the movements, personify the movements.
And it's this combination. In fact,
like Julius Caesar.
Right, Julius Caesar, right. And when you look at the history of a great man, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag. You have Kublai Khan. People forget that
Kublai Khan. No, they're not good. We're going to get to that point. Right. This doesn't mean that they're good people.
The incredible people. But in America, for example, there have really been three great presidents. And they are the presidents at their time and the place that they were really needed. And their presence affected the change that stabilized the society. And we're talking about Washington,
Lincoln,
and FDR. Okay. Homie, and right, so far, you got a C-plus going right now. I wasn't crazy about your last term.
Darn it.
term paper. And the reality is, when you think about it, why Washington? You know, in some sense, Washington has been at the top. I do all these wonderful surveys about the greatest presidents, and Lincoln is now supreme over everyone. But Washington is always up there. If not one, he's two or three or one, two or three, because he was the first person to hold office. And in a very real sense, Washington understood that everything he did was setting a precedent. Because there had never been a president in the world. Right. That wonderful song that King George sings in Hamilton is, what is he? He's not really, he's going to change every 4 to 8 years? This is ridiculous authority. And Hamilton's, you know, the thing that we didn't like about Hamilton, initially when the Federalist Papers and when we were writing the Constitution, Hamilton wanted a lifelong presidency. And that too much mimicked a monarch, so that wasn't acceptable to Jefferson.
But even back to, that is interesting because the crisis of the time was starting something new, starting a new country.
Sorry to be very careful.
And what I love about it, you're right. When you look back at some of the ways that Washington created policy, or even some of the great quotes that he did, they're all about understanding where he is and his role at that moment.
Absolutely, and his demeanor. He didn't carry a sword. He did not dress in military garb once he became elected.
And he could have. It wouldn't have made a difference. It's
because
he had been commander
of the armed forces.
He was commander.
And by the way, a little known fact that under Adams, he was reappointed as commander of the armed forces when Adams had to raise an army. But he lived out this theory. He lived out the presidency. He was a hero in war and peace. Lincoln, of course, it's almost, I've been studying Mandela this week. It's been I'm through with finals. Graduation is over.
This is what you do when school's out?
I read books for 12 hours a day. It is heaven, okay? But I've been reading Mandela. And will we ever fully understand Mandela? Because he's such an iconic figure. Do we find out, you know, what kind of a saint he was? Or was he, what was he doing? But Lincoln is so large, it's hard to get over his martyrdom. It's hard to get over his iconic reverence. He's a secular saint. But in reality, Lincoln had fought slavery, fought a civil war that's still not over in some real sense ideologically, and he redefined democracy in America. The Gettysburg Address is the most important 272 words ever written in our political system, that this nation belongs to the people, for the people, and by the people.
And he knew he had to write that at that moment.
He knew that, because democracy, not just slavery, democracy was at risk. And FDR, the same way. You know, we talk about FDR, the Great Depression, and every undergraduate knows a part of FDR's opening speech, inaugural speech. The only thing we have to fear is
fear bugs in my ears.
Fear bugs in my ears. All right, we're down to C-, but we'll get back to on that.
Oh, Professor. It was a long night last night.
Long night. Anyway, we won the basketball tournament. Can I have an extension? By the way, my students on the team turned in their papers on time.
That's great.
I'm so proud of them. Anyway, in a very real sense, he not only fought the Depression, He fought for democracy. It was not a given thing. There were a couple of people that were really worried about Huey Long and one General Douglas MacArthur. Would democracy as we understood it fall apart? He saved the nation spiritually, economically, and politically. And because of that, they are awarded, you know, they're awarded that. And I think we have to remember, great leaders are great and effective in what they do. They can be compassionate, all that. But there's a warning here. You know, got to be careful about great leaders. As Churchill once said, for Russians, their worst misfortune was that Lenin was born. Their next worst misfortune was he died, and therefore Stalin.
Well, let's talk about Winston Churchill, because a lot of this plays out. Yes. We're talking about the great man theory, and of course, does that mean that a great man means a great leader tonight? The resident philosopher Al Genie is in studio. He's the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago. Joins us once a month. We'll take a quick break. 312-981-7200 if you want to get in on the convo. We'll be right back. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. It's a monthly visit to the show. Professor Al Genie, our resident philosopher, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago. Tonight we're talking about the great man theory and this idea that heroes shape history. And this was Thomas Carlyle who famously said, the history of the world is but the biography of great men.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just kind of set up what that was in the last segment. But let's talk about the modern.
Yeah,
we talked about the 20th century modern great man theory.
And this is historians reporting, and I'm just reporting on historians. But in the 20th century, historians suggest, don't forget we're in the 21st century, there are only six great leaders, world impactful leaders. And it's two against four, and the good guys are losing. The two good guys are FDR and Churchill, and that's we can explain more about that. But the bad guys are Hitler, Lenin, Stalin, and Mao Zedong. And this is fantastic. And some historians put in, as possible good guys, Mandela and Gandhi. But Mandela then is out in the 2000s, and so his activism was in before the turn of the century, so on and so forth. But certainly we'd have to put him in that milieu, and Gandhi, I would also put that milieu. But the reality is the bad guys outweigh the good guys. And if you look at modern day great leaders, and we're not talking about are they great in their impact now, are they great in their goodness right now, or in their beneficence, you have Trump, Putin, Xi Jinping, which I always mispronounce, please forgive me.
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, and so you...
Right, and North Korea would be someone who fits into this mold.
Well, he's a small... He is affecting world change because of a couple devices, but he doesn't have... Okay. I think what historians would talk about is this great sociological impact and economic impact.
Let me ask you, I mean, the word great is probably what sticks in people's mind. I mean, man, it's again, man, woman, this is an old theory, but this idea of great, because you're right, two what we would consider to be good guys and four bad guys.
Right.
And great kind of always throws people off because you don't want to throw superlatives like the word great on top of
great
somebody
here
who's
means
a mass
effective.
Murderer.
What have they done? What has been their affect on the world? How have they changed the world? Again, what have they done to save their social system? So there's a lot of great men who have been, that is in the news, who have been actually counterproductive in that in America. Joe McCarthy, Huey Long, Father Coughlin. You wouldn't remember that. That would be 1932. Trust me, I was there. David Duke, Jim Jones, Paul Pot, Mussolini, Saddam Hussein, Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, what's his name from Libya? I'm blanking on his name right now. Gaddafi, excuse me.
Yeah.
What you have here is effective men who have had real power, but have they been great to their society? That's the difference. How have individuals been great? You would say that Catherine the Great was a great ruler because Catherine the Great, in some sense, brought Russia from kind of a Byzantine post-medieval world and tried to drag Russia into the modern world, the beginning of that process of dragging modern to the Russian world. We can say that very, very clearly that the individuals have impact in how they have changed the world. So whether they're good or bad, we have to admit that Adolf Hitler was a great,
effective leader. Right.
And when you look at the 20th century, when we used to be on another channel, when we did all those things in the year 2000, the most effective thing, Adolf Hitler came at the top of everything because he changed the structure of Europe, the face of Europe, the designation of countries, the 68 million people dead in World War II, and how that changed the whole world because one man I would say the right thing at the right time, it happened to be the wrong message.
But that's what you're talking about.
Right.
This idea that do great when we just define, that's defining great men.
Right, right.
But when you talk about great leaders,
yeah,
and whether or not their effect is for good, if they're changing the world in a good way, you start to see a lot of these names fall off.
They do fall off. But I think you're misinterpreting historians when they say great men very often, again, have affect. Now, are they selfish or selfless?
Right.
Are they beneficial or are they draconianly nihilistic? And I think that we have to put down, you know, in a very real sense, we always put down Hitler, but we've forgotten the fact that Joseph Stalin probably killed off 38 million of his own people in order to impose a dialectical system that never really worked. And by the way, you recommended that film to me.
Such a great film, isn't it?
And I didn't like it at all, and I'm so sorry.
Do not listen to Professor. This is the... I forgot the name of it.
Yeah, Death of Stalin. No, Stalin...
Yeah, Death of Stalin.
Yeah.
That was a great film. You're wrong.
Okay, you're right on this, but you're wrong. But Stalin, you have to remember, controlled the whole society. Lenin was there and had the ideological base, even if he got lost in that ideological base. And then Stalin came in and became this draconian...
Yeah.
Autocrat that ran a society, ruled a society, put people in jail, killed them for any reason whatsoever, did anything he wanted to do, redirected a whole national income, how people farmed, et cetera, et cetera. We're still fighting those battles in the Caribbean.
We have a break coming up here, and then I want to get to Winston Churchill because he seems to embody all of it. But I'm fascinated when I think of what we consider to be modern leaders and how they'll be viewed in history.
Yeah.
When you talk about the great man theory, let's talk about our former president, Barack Obama, as a good example. You know, do social movements that he – I mean, he'll be responsible for legalizing gay marriage, right? That'll be on his legacy for
right.
Do those social movements, do they move the needle and put him in that category?
From an uber-historical point of view, the answer is no, because those are existential dilemmas which are being resolved. I am a fan of Barack Obama. I think he was a great and a good man.
But he wouldn't fit in these categories.
And had the gravitas of the presidency, and his demeanor as a president and as a bureaucrat was beyond, you know, it certainly doesn't even compare to our present president, but hey, I think he's going to go down as a C-plus, at best, effective president, and certainly does not fall in the category of a great man.
But even, I was going to say, maybe less president, but more about leader, as we talk about great men and great leaders. But yeah, okay. And, you know, we'll come up, because I know that the elephant in the room right now is President Trump, and does he fit into this category? Because all of the things that you mentioned at the top, and even the stuff that you're talking about with the 20th century leaders, there are a lot of similarities to the way that this president has led in his role and leads the United States of America right now. We'll talk more about him as well as Winston Churchill coming up here. Professor Al Genie is here. He's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. He's our resident philosopher. We're talking about the great man theater and whether or theater theory, the great man theory and whether that translates into great leadership here on The Download tonight. Stay with us. Thank you, Mr. Mark Teer. Justin Kaufman here. It's a Download 720 WGN with you till 11 o'clock tonight, 312-981-7200. We are talking about the great man theory, as we have changed it to the great man woman theory. Just because this is an outdated 19th century philosophers, Thomas Carlyle, the great man theory, essentially heroes make history. That's the concept we're talking about tonight.
Right.
And whether or not...
Successful heroes.
Yeah, I was going to say, whether or not being a great man means you're a great leader, and also getting into some of the stories about some of the people that are considered to be great men that didn't translate to great leadership,
and
history's not going to remember that.
And the best example of what Carlyle means is Winston Churchill. That's why this whole thing started, because of the movie we were talking about it, and so on and so forth. And Churchill is a resounding rebuttal to the Marxist historians who think that history, you know, that history is written by vast and personal economic forces. Excuse me. In point of fact, Churchill was the right man at the right time with the right ingredients, with the right capacities, with the right background, with the correct answers, who saw what was happening and was willing to act and risk acting on that. And in a very real sense, without Winston Churchill, they've done this. Churchill is the orchestrator of the saving of the world in World War II. He couldn't do it alone. Little tiny Britain, you know, almost lost all of its forces on the beaches of Dunkirk and then had to rebuild. And all those armaments were thanks to my mother, who was, you know, who was working, Rosie the Riveter, right? She made M4s. That's what my mom did during the war, right?
Wow.
And the reality is the United States became the arsenal of the world and producing enough for the Russian forces, for every force out there. But Churchill was a great orchestrator. Churchill was the great maestro of what's going on. There's a wonderful story that when Hitler stupidly said, well, we're not going to bomb them anymore. Let's just take Russia. He called up FDR and says, one down. And then when Japan hit Pearl Harbor, he called up FDR and says, we've won. Now we have to play it out. And in a very real sense, Churchill came to in the late 30s or early 30s, he was a backbencher. He had been many, many things. He had been in government
in
total 62 years. He was back there, and he had failed in a number of things. Gallipoli was a great, great mistake, although, as he argued very clearly, the Admiralty didn't get there in time. It was a great plan. I was trying to divert the things in Europe. He had been a soldier. By the time he was 25, he'd been in three, maybe four wars. Most shot at executive ever in the history of the world. It's fascinating stuff. An historian, a news reporter, but more than anything, what I think people don't totally appreciate, my friend Ron Green and I wrote a paper on this years and years ago. Churchill was manic depressive. He called it black dog. Of course, drinking all that alcohol didn't exactly help. He was A-type, an incredible A-type, incredible energy. I mean, he survived more strokes than any human being should be able to do and died at the age of 92. But during when Hitler was first coming to power, and, don't forget, the powers in England were partly German, saying, well, this is just another politician. Hitler saying, no, this is a Nazi. It is the devil. This is evil. This is medieval evil against the ideology of democracy.
And that goes back to the right place,
and
right
time.
And
we need to fight this man.
Right.
This is not just another political leader. This man is going to change the course
of
the world.
Well, that's what that Gary Oldman movie was talking about, Darkest Hour, was essentially that Churchill was the one that stood up and actually went against the grain,
Absolutely against the grain, and said it's wrong. But not only was he a herald of this, he orchestrated it. That is, he planned it. He understood detail. He had incredible energy. Now, having said all that, before anybody calls up and says, oh, my God, you got to be kidding. There's all kinds of revisionist history about Churchill right now. This is not a man without fault. This is a great political big stage player. But personally, this man is not without fault. First of all, his personal finances were always in total disarray. He was borrowing money from everybody, taking money from everybody in order to keep going. His politics, he made many mistakes politically. Excuse me, I'm very sorry. The black and tans he brought into Ireland, he used poisonous gas in World War I. He says, they're using it, why can't we use it? His was a lesser gas, by the way, he said. Right. Using troops to stop the strikes, so on and so forth. He was a white supremacist. He was, believer in Darwin, that the white race had won.
So what, I guess...
Hated Gandhi.
All those things that you just said, in my feeble mind, would disqualify him as a great man.
Right. You might not necessarily have dinner with him, but you would want him to cut out your gallbladder.
And this goes back to But this goes back to the original, the word great. It confuses people when we put Churchill up on a pedestal because of what he meant to that moment in that time to change the course or correct the course of history. That makes him a hero in history.
Right. So what
doesn't mean he has to be a great guy.
No, it doesn't mean he has to be a great guy. But in point of fact, he transcended his own selfish egoism. I mean, he really was a great person. And there's a wonderful story about his grandchild running into him and says, Grandpa, somebody said to me that you're the greatest man in the whole world. And he looked at him and says, yes, stupid, now get out. Because he was busy doing stuff.
Right.
The reality is, maybe we should change this to the affect leadership, the greatest affect in leadership. He got things done when England was going to fall. If England fell, it was not only symbolic fall, it meant that Germany, and there's a whole series of novels out there, including the one on Netflix right now that I'm in the tower, where Germany wins all of Europe. So you've got the United States of Germany and Japan takes everything, and the United States is bereft between them. That could have happened. At one point.
Okay, so let's get right to it. I think about a lot of what we're talking about, and we a lot of this area seems to apply to the current president, President Trump. And more importantly, here's a question I'll ask you, because we don't have to get specifically into whether or not he fits the bill and what you think of the president, any of that stuff. What I'm more interested in is when you look at how the country voted in 2016. And there's a lot of questions to why. Why would people vote for Trump? Why would we scratch? I mean, there are books written about this stuff, and the mainstream media has opinion after opinion scratching heads about why this is. And you recognize that he fits the bill when it comes to the great man theory, that Carlyle, that the people, me, you, other people around, we're also attracted to this theory. This theory plays out in the sense that we want that in our leadership. We want the great man theory to be associated with who leads our country.
All right. Let's be real careful here. First of all, I think most Republicans and Democrats who are not grinding some specific political agenda have suggested that no one expected Mr. Trump to win, and neither did Trump's camp expect to win, and then he won, and that he became the agent of change in America. We're tired of all these rascals. Let's try something else. That's just a given. He won. Fair and square. Yeah. He beat Hillary like a drum.
Sure.
Boom. All right. Put that aside. Now, is he a great man? And the answer is, he might be, but he hasn't proven it yet. That is, he has not yet handled or resolved a great
crisis.
Now,
people,
we're on the border. We're kissing it.
But
right
I would
now.
Also, I would, I guess, I would ask you, and this is where history becomes the issue. Look, you okay there?
It's, if I die,
I real, just, real.
Tell my children I didn't like them that much. Okay,
I get real torn up here. All right, no, but even beyond that, some in this country, the people who voted for the president, would think we are in that crisis. That the country's going in the wrong direction, that this is that moment, this is that fulcrum
given that
point.
Scenario.
So if that's the scenario, they brought in the great man that they would believe would fit the bill in the great man theory. That's why he rose the ranks through the Republican primary, and that's why he was voted into president.
Yes, Brian, your scenario, and putting aside my own personal predictions.
Sure, mine too, sure.
If he fulfills this agenda of changing the Iranian package, changing the trade packages around the world, altering the state of our hegemony throughout the world.
Whatever he's
demilitarizing the Korean zone, he is a great leader. Therefore, he will be. But he has to affect
but
that.
But I guess the question that I ask is, does he have to do all of the current policy things you just mentioned to be a great leader?
I think
they're all tied together.
I think a great leader means you've changed the course, changed the direction, or saved the nation. Now, you asked me before about Mr. Obama. If Mr. Obama's agenda had been totally fulfilled, we would have to call him a great leader because he wanted world peace. He got the Nobel Prize for it. He ended the recession.
I mean, I'll turn my own words against me. I mean, you could make the argument that he as well came in at the Wall Street was crashing, the economy was crashing.
Right.
This could have been a situation where the ship crashed into the seashore,
right.
And the president came in and in this crisis rose to great leadership.
That's right. It is. I heard him say this in a private conversation. When I won in November, I thought my biggest problems were going to be Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan, not General Motors, Ford, the banking industry, and the mortgage industry.
Right.
He never anticipated that he would spend 18 months of his first 2 years in office saving this country and the world from going to the Depression. I'm not enough of an historian. I'm not enough of a political scientist to say, therefore, it follows he's a great leader. But I want to follow up on your argument. If Trump accomplishes his grandiose goals and alters the sociological, financial, and political direction of the society, yes, we'll have to call him an effective leader.
There you
go.
No, I agree. I think about it and think about the words that we've been talking about in this last hour, and you rip just kind of to peel away the day to day and everything that's being reported and everything about whether or not he's just or whether he's ethical or whether he's moral. Along the lines, you push that out of the way because, as you said, Winston Churchill didn't fit that category. You could even make an argument that some of the great leaders mentioned before in the 20th century, the great Lincoln, you know, a lot may not fit that category.
Remember, Mr. Lincoln was greatly hated, and the Sun-Times, the editor of the Sun-Times thought him dim-witted, dull, and ignorant, just for openers. It wasn't called the Sun-Times at the time.
Yeah, the issue, I think, at the end of the day is separating. When you talk about great leadership, there still is this notion that we want our leader to think of someone bigger than themselves. We want them to be selfless. We want them to speak in this kind of way for the country when we can't. Right? You want even George W. Bush standing up after 9/11, you want your leaders to be able to say the things that you need to say or say the words that bring a country together. That's out right now. The jury's out on whether or not, and I'm not sure that even fits whether or not history considers.
I think you're a Chicago Paul, and you're reducing this to a certain kind of parochial nature. I think the great man theory is about leaders, good or bad, but we want good. Good or bad, that alter the structure of their society and perhaps the nation. Of the world, I'm sorry, of the world. Therefore, we can say that that list that I gave you before, they are clearly effective leaders. Stalin, great, not in the sense of good, no. FDR, great, yeah, probably in the sense of good. Certainly Lincoln, so on and so forth. But can Churchill, can Trump, I just associated Churchill with Trump, and he himself does that. can Trump wind up being a great leader? Yeah, but, and I think it's connected to the foreign policy and the economics. Can he alter how America is perceived in the world and how Americans perceive themselves in the world? That would constitute great leadership. I don't, and it, whether that's good or bad. Now, if that means we become totally nationalistic, which I'm afraid of, it seems to me that the great leaders in the world right now are powerful leaders. Certainly, Mr. Putin is a powerful, effective leader. But what he wants is to re-czarify Russia. He wants to make Russia an empire again. He's already said three times in the last 18 months, the greatest mistake was breaking up the Soviet Union. And because at least we were this great power. He was a Democrat for a while, then a capitalist for a while, and now he's an autocrat. And will he be a czar soon? Does that make him a great leader? Well, it does historically, but let's ask the philosophical question. Do we want great leaders or do we want good leaders? And that's the dilemma in front of us.
Yeah.
Who do we want to be in charge of our lives? Who do we want to direct us? We have an election coming up right now. There are how many candidates? 9, 10 of them. Every hue of the color spectrum right now is running for it. Every sexual proclivity is out there. I think this is a wonderful opportunity to say, let's vote for the correct moral candidate. What a concept.
That's great. What a concept. And I feel like that all along, that's what this segment is about, whether or not that theory stands
right.
up. Whether or not the great man theory, it's
right.
time to say fourth and eight, punt it.
Right. And it stands up in regard to Churchill and what he did and his use of words, as John F. Kennedy says, Churchill marched wards off to war and mobilized us in the process, right? And he saved the world by orchestrating the world. It's like Bernstein. What did Bernstein play? Do you know the instruments that Bernstein played?
Hmm.
Well, as Steve Jobs says, he doesn't have to play anything. He plays the orchestra. And that's what Churchill did. He played the orchestra.
I love it. You get such a thing for Churchill.
We're both short. We both drink a lot of bourbon. I'm not short, ladies and gentlemen.
Professor Al Genie in studio, our resident philosopher, also the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. So we got to figure out, you're coming up in June because you're taking a trip. You're getting out of
here. I'm lecturing in South Africa on leadership. You know, if you write a couple of books and you have an expensive suit and you're more than 1,000 miles away from home, they think you're an expert.
You should bring me out. We can have this conversation. We can do this in front of the...
How about if we procrastinate when next we meet?
There you go, yeah.
We're going to procrastinate.
Oh, that's good. Procrastination. Okay. Great. Professor Al Genie, great to see you, bud.
Good to see you.
Nate, we got to change the name of that theory. Essentially, the idea, and I love that combo, and I always love when Al Genie comes in. As somebody, 847 says, we need a leader that cares about all of us, not just himself. Donald Trump is not that leader. That may be true, and it's definitely an affect that people desire. But history is written by the heroes, and history says that the greatest leaders are great men. Now, that doesn't mean, again, the word great is what throws people off. Great doesn't mean, what a great guy! It means great as it follows the categories that the professor laid out, which would include 6 modern leaders, 2 of which are good guys, 4 of which not so good. So you can understand where that word seems to get in the way, and maybe it's just time to drop kick that whole theory and say from here on out, let's stay away from the great men. Just, I don't know, maybe that's something we could do. Just rewrite history. I think we can do that. All right, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we'll talk a little royal wedding, and also Professor Matthew Shinoda is here. He is a poet, and he's also a professor at Columbia College, and he does a whole anti-racism workshop. You know, there's so much going on right now. We talked about this in the Reload segment on Friday about the Yale student who called the cops on a Yale student sleeping. We had the Starbucks situation, but it just seems to me that we have to have that talk. We have to start thinking more about race and race relations and just get to why we are back in this scenario where we aren't understanding each other. Matthew Shinoda does this for Columbia College. He does, like I said, an anti-racism workshop. We'll talk about the tenets and really how he presents that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then Greg Flamm tonight, swap meet 312-981-7200. Collectibles, memorabilia, junk. You got the best brag. I'll give you a pizza tonight. How about that? It's all coming up. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It is a download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9:30, Fred Weintraub's going to join us. He is Chicago's, I think he's unofficial, but official reporter on the royal family. You see him everywhere. He's doing a bunch of different media because he is lives in London, and he has does a lot of freelance work to cover the royal family, and of course the big wedding coming up here. So we'll talk a little bit about what he's learned. Interesting concept that he went into it thinking that it was just almost like the British Kardashians. And coming out of it, he realized it's much more than that, and to the culture and the community there. And so he'll talk to us, give us some insights coming up here at 9:30. Greg Flamm and the swap meet coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, America, I think it's time that we have that talk. No, not the one about the birds and the bees. You can learn that on the internet. No, I'm talking about race. In the last week, we've seen more and more cases of racial profiling, discrimination, and downright miscommunication happening all over the country. And it seems more than ever, we need to have a serious, honest conversation about why race and racism continues. That's at the heart of my next guest's syllabus, if you will, Professor Matthew Shinoda. In addition to being a professor of English and creative writing at Columbia College, he's also the Dean of Academic Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. He's introduced an Undoing Racism workshop that's considered one of the most comprehensive anti-racism trainings of any academic institution in the country. And at the core, it's all about opening up and seeing things differently. Professor Matthew Shinoda, welcome to The Download. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
So let's talk about this. Let's first, we have to have that talk. It seems more than I've, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen really strange incidents, calling the police when someone wants to use the bathroom. We seem to be regressing in a way. Yeah. Do you see it the same way? I mean, is it time for this country to sit down and have that talk?
Well, I think it's been time for quite a long time. I mean, I think that race is one of those central and core issues in the history of this country that we have done a fairly good job of navigating around for the last 400 years or so. And I think many things are coming to a head, and it's time that we kind of confront these issues more directly. And I think the idea of having a talk specifically in relation to one's own family and community, not just for communities of color, but for white folks as well, I think is a really important place to begin, that we're not going to move forward and progress in any way unless we actually address these issues head on.
And a lot of that is how people feel. And you know, a lot of what you talk about in the Undoing Racism workshop is about seeing things from different people's perspectives. Mm-hmm. More often than not, if I talk about race on this program, and it happens a lot, there will be texters right away texting in and telling me what somebody thinks, telling me what somebody feels, and not necessarily opening up and showing empathy or understanding where the other person is coming from.
Well, and I think a big piece of that is to actually not only focus on how we feel, but to talk about how race operates systemically in this society. And that's one of the things, the Undoing Racism workshops that we're hosting at Columbia College Chicago, which are put on by an organization out of New Orleans called the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. They've been around roughly 40 years and have done trainings and workshops all over the country and the world. But one of the main focuses there is to get people to see how race has permeated into all of the systems that govern our lives, right? So that people don't just see this as a personal thing, don't just see this as an issue of guilt or, you know, some sort of personal responsibility, but understand the way that these things operate systemically and affect our lives, even when we don't intend for them to.
You do this, the workshop at Columbia College, and you also have, you're the Dean of Academic Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Why is it necessary there? I think at Columbia College, it's a pretty diverse student body. I know Absolutely. It. I went there. I mean, talk about the need for this kind of thing, even when you do have a diverse student body together.
I mean, I think there's a couple of ways to look at that. One, I think that this kind of work has always been at the core of Columbia College's mission. And so with our current president, Dr. Kwangwoo Kim, and other leadership, we decided to really take it more head on and make it a more systemic core part of the institution's mission, with really a goal of becoming an anti-racist institution and to shift our curriculum in a way that, that really fully addresses the histories and the lived experiences of our very diverse student body. And as is the case in many academic institutions, we've got a fairly diverse student body, the faculty less so, and the curriculum even less so. Many of us, you know, teach the same kinds of curriculum we were taught. And so a lot of my work focuses on pushing the curriculum to address these issues more systemically in the classroom and get people to understand and think about and see the world from different perspectives and different frames of reference. And of course, because we teach a lot of creative disciplines, art and media-based disciplines, it's a really rich environment to shift and lead the conversation ultimately.
Usually when you get an office that's the Dean of Academic Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion and workshops called Undoing Racism, it's because there was an incident. Right? That's usually how it works. This was either required, mandatory, or possibly getting in front of something that is just bad press. That's not the case at Columbia.
No, though our institution, like any other, has had its share of incidences here and there over the years. This was not the impetus for this particular moment. This was actually part of our institutional strategic plan around really institutionalizing an anti-racist perspective in our curriculum, in our faculty, in our students, and in the things that we teach. And again, really kind of, in a way, matching what has been a relatively progressive mission for the college for so many years with some very real concrete steps in doing that work in the day-to-day.
There, I mean, you, as you said, anti-racism, strategic approach to the college and to everything that goes from curriculum, student body down. I think a lot of institutions would say, "Hey, I'm anti-racist, right? Hey, don't. If you're anti-racist, I'm anti-racist. There's no racism here. You're looking in the wrong direction." So, what do you mean by an anti-racist agenda? What I mean, because I would think everyone listening right now would say, "I feel like I'm anti-racist."
Well, I think that the term anti-racist really signifies a kind of proactive engagement, right? It's one thing to be opposed to racism. It's one thing to have a kind of moral stand against discriminatory or biased behavior. It's another thing to be proactive around making sure that the systems and the things that we engage in on a daily basis are actually equitable, inclusive, and work towards creating a level playing field, so to speak, right? And I think those are very different things.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, ours is a very liberal institution. I think the majority of my colleagues would certainly say that on a personal level, they're anti-racist. But that doesn't mean that the curriculum they're teaching is not heavily weighted towards Western European thinking and Western European sources and so on. And so we have to take very proactive measures to really begin to engage that conversation and create what I think is a really rich and welcoming and wonderful space, especially in the creative disciplines, to think about and create work from various perspectives.
Well, let's do this. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about how you do that. When we talk about undoing racism, but also having an anti-racist agenda and what you have to do to essentially approach a curriculum, approach the student body, and understand what it means to level the playing field. In studio tonight, Matthew Shinoda. He's a professor at Columbia College of English and Creative Writing. He's also the Dean of Academic Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. He's my guest. He's a poet as well. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio, Professor Matthew Shinoda from Columbia College, English and Creative Writing professor. He's also the Dean of Academic Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. He's introduced an Undoing Racism workshop at the college, which is one of the more comprehensive anti-racism trainings of any academic institution in this country. And what it really does, it's not the kind of workshop that you would think, like, say, when a coffee shop has an incident. It's not that kind of thing, because what you're really doing is setting forth an anti-racist agenda, a way to really level the playing field when it comes to not just the student body and how relationships between people of different backgrounds come together, but really how you teach the work, how you present the work. What are the tools that you use for that? When I'm thinking of curriculum, mm-hmm. I'm thinking someone says, I want to do a history class. How do do you approach it? I mean, what are the questions you have to ask to fulfill an anti-racist agenda?
Well, I think that there are a great many. And the first is to kind of do an analysis of your own perspective and to figure out whether you're being fully inclusive and thinking about other perspectives and where your own areas of weakness are. And we all have them. And to try to work on developing that. I mean, as faculty, as professors, we're constantly learning and doing research and engaging in our own fields. And we can do that with a specific eye towards anti-racism, right? And then thinking about the ways that we act as gatekeepers, which is a kind of core concept in this work, right? That all of us act as gatekeepers in various ways. We present the syllabi to our students. We create the curriculum for them, right? And so if there are holes in the curriculum, if there are areas that are kind of locking out certain communities and their perspectives, we have the ability to continue to reify and perpetuate that or to change that.
A lot of people will say history is history. You know, why?
Well, there are many histories.
Right, but that's my point. That, I mean, a lot of people say, why is this now? Why are we doing this now? But, you know, when I grew up and I was in high school or I was in college, the history was a history. Why does it have to change?
Well, I don't know that history has changed. I think that it's about actually teaching the fullness of history, which we've never done. And, you know, you could say that this is the way things were in the past, but, you know, I don't buy that argument. I don't think the past was particularly glorious for most human beings. And when you look at the present, is this what we're aiming for, right? Can we do better? I think we can. I think as a nation, we can do far better. You had mentioned at the beginning of the show, all of these incidences happening around the country, right? The kind of fear and anger and confusion around issues of race that exist across the country in so many ways is palpable and it's real. And we have to find ways to begin to address that. And ignoring it, which is what going back to traditional history models does, right, is not going to get us anywhere. We've been ignoring it for 400 years, and it's time that we really focus on moving forward.
How do you, when I think of the student body, and I'm you know, you want to get kids together, when you talk about introducing them to anti-racism or to a workshop called Undoing Racism, how do they respond? I mean, a lot of kids come in and they're open-minded college kids.
Sure.
And I would assume that quickly they figure out that they're not as open-minded as they thought.
You know, I mean, I think generally, and this is probably true across the ages, the youth are far more open than we are. But I think, by and large, one of the things we're focusing on is doing these workshops for the faculty and staff, right? So that we actually shape the things, the systems that engage these students to reflect these things. So it's not about necessarily putting them through these workshops, right, but rather training ourselves in order to shift the conversation. They're poised and ready for it. And because we already have an incredibly diverse student body, this is really about a level of inclusiveness and making sure that each of the people in the room's own histories and realities and lived experiences are reflected in the curriculum, that there is a place for them to express and engage and create and make art and media and so on and so forth that reflect.
Now, what I know of many professors and instructors who have had at Columbia College, they're independent thinkers and they're strong-willed people, and that's why they have the jobs they have. So, I mean, it's not as easy as just saying, snap the fingers and saying, hey, we're all getting together as a workshop, right, and now we all understand each other better. I mean, I would assume that there's a lot of conflict that comes out of that.
Certainly. And I think, you know, this is long-range work, and that's very important, right? I think that when you're trying to do this work at an institutional level, you have to be committed to doing this work over a period of time. It takes myriad steps and it takes a lot of engagement, and not everybody's going to come on board with that, but I think in our case we're fortunate that a good majority of our faculty are very open to this. But we also have to understand that they need certain resources and the ability and the time to develop these things as they move forward, right? This is not an overnight thing. And of course, you know, we take education seriously, so the things that we present in the classroom have to be well-researched, the person has to have an expertise in it, so on and so forth. So this is also about bringing new faculty to the table. When we talk about students, for example, and this is true generally across the country, student bodies are significantly more diverse than their faculty. This is true at virtually every institution of higher education in the nation, right? And so we have to work on the diversity of the faculty, not just in terms of the individuals who are in the room, which I think is important, but the expertise of those people, right? People who have studied these things, people who do have alternative views of history than the mainstream and so on, right? So you have to put all of those things together and commit to a very kind of long-range engagement.
Do you see a sort of, and I hesitate to use the word trickle-down, but this concept that by training a faculty to teach the students, that those students are going to graduate from school, and because all of this can exist within the walls, or not walls, but the institution that is Columbia College, and then you're out into the world where they have not taken the workshop, that people, right. that students will run into conflict where there is racism, as we see, whether it's in a coffee shop or in a boardroom. Do you see this kind of work being a pathway for those students to be able to handle those situations better, or be the driving force that eradicates it altogether?
Well, I think, my hope would be that they become a driving force to make change. I mean, we have no illusion that we're somehow going to change the whole of society, but part of the goal of education is, of course, to present a safe alternative space in which to engage these things, so that when people go out into the world, they have the tools and the skill and the ability to shift the boardroom and the coffee shop and so on and so forth, right? So the hope is that they will actually begin to take this work out into the world and infect the various places that they're working.
In the short time that you've been doing the workshops, I mean, are there strides? I mean, are there things you look at and you say, oh, I never thought that we would be at this place. I never thought in the short amount of time that I've been doing this that I would see this kind of response. Or are there other, on the flip side, frustrations that things aren't moving faster? Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think both are true. I think that there have been some really wonderful moments of seeing certain colleagues turn a corner in a way that I didn't expect so quickly, and seeing them become very open and really have a deep desire to push forward and learn more. And there have been other folks who have been fairly entrenched, right? This is hard work. I mean, one of the things that happens in any of these kinds of scenarios is that you're challenging the preconceived notions that in many cases people have had since they were children, right? That it's a tall order. It's difficult, right? Some people are more open to that than others, right?
Right.
It's work. At the end of the day, it's work, and it's hard work, and so people have to be committed to that, right? And for many people, especially those who are part of the dominant majority, right, they're comfortable, right? So doing this work unsettles them. It means giving up power. It means shifting power in various ways. It means walking into a classroom, perhaps, and saying, I don't know some of these things, and I need to do my own work to figure this out, right? And that's an unsettling thing for many people, right? So obviously some are more open and more comfortable than others. But again, the my point is that the institution has to remain committed and not shift the target, regardless of whether every individual is on board or not.
Matthew Shinoda is the professor of English and creative writing at Columbia College. He's also the dean of academic diversity, equity, and inclusion. He runs an anti-racism workshop and training. It really is one of the more comprehensive anti-racism trainings of any academic institution in this country at Columbia College, right here in Chicago. Matthew, thanks so much for coming in and talking, and
thanks.
I look forward to
me.
Continuing the conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. For Download 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this weekend, the world will watch a wedding. The royal wedding starring Prince Harry and his princess-to-be, Meghan Markle. British royals know how to do weddings. So much so that they usually are the most watched events on television. But what is it about these events that garner so much attention? Fred Weintraub joins me tonight. Fred, longtime Chicago journalist and longtime WGN contributor who splits his time between London, Chicago, and Houston. He covers the royal family. This is his time to shine to tell us all about the royals and why they continue to fascinate and capture the world's attention. Weintraub works for WCIU in Chicago as a contributor to the morning show The Jam, and he joins me tonight. Fred, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
So this really is your time to shine. You almost become a de facto representative of Royals culture to the city of Chicago. You're on different shows, you're in different areas. Do you like that role, being the Chicago's representative of the Royals?
I do. It's kind of, it's a window of opportunity. I kind of live a three-part life in that I'm a broadcaster from Chicago. I have been general manager of a group of television stations. I've traveled a different path than probably most people. But I started out right out of college as a reporter, so my heart is always, just like whether you're a TV reporter or a radio reporter, no matter what you go into next, you're still a reporter at heart. And a reporter is a person who gathers information. I just happen to be a person who spends enough time in London that I can gather as much firsthand information as you can reasonably gather when you're covering the royals.
Well, I was going to say, a lot of people who are listening tonight are like, oh, great, I want to hear all about the royal wedding. And I'm going to take us down a different path because I want to know all about Fred. About 10 years ago, you moved to London. You say you want to get into covering the royals. How intimidating was that? I mean, you don't know the culture. You don't necessarily know how to cover a royal family. What did you think you were getting into?
So here's the long and short of it. I had this career, which has been a great career, in Chicago. My wife, who works for a global oil company, came home one day and said, I have an opportunity in London. And I thought, being the good husband that I like to be, that if she had a 99% opportunity of having this happen to her, why wouldn't I be supportive? She's been supportive of all the craziness that goes on in broadcasting. Right, I thought that was the least I could do. So I worked out an arrangement with Weigel Broadcasting. And then off we were for the first time when we first went to London about 8 years ago. And I thought, okay, I've got to, reporters don't just sit around and do nothing. And so while I'm there, I better figure something out. So, I heard about the royal family like everybody else. I read all the stuff. I watched all the things. And I thought, I'm going to go check out my first royal event and just get a sense of what it was. And I can remember the first royal event was probably 8.5 years ago when Queen Elizabeth was going to participate in a service at St. Paul's Cathedral. And I must have been able to talk my way into the reporter's bullpen area, because no matter what anybody says about you're a royal correspondent, you're, Chicago's royal watcher. I mean, there are 5,000 royal watchers in London, in the UK right now. Wow. Now, the truth is, the royal family sends out press releases. It's not like they're sitting down and doing, unless you're the Walter Cronkite of the BBC, they're not sitting down with Fred Weintraub or almost anybody else and dishing out information. So you have to put pieces of the puzzle together. But for the first part for me was figuring out, okay, is it like the president of the United States that I'm going to be so far away that I'm going to have no clue? I'm going to have to use binoculars to figure out where Queen Elizabeth is. And then I figured out that, no, if you could figure out where the beat reporters in London are, you can work your way in there. You figure out what events you're going to go to. So I started out with a big event, which at St. Paul's is pretty big. And I will tell you, while I am not starstruck anymore, not to say that it's not exciting to see the Queen of England when she comes out of whatever event she's coming out of, it's less starstruckness for me at this point and more of a respect of how she's turned this stodgy, historic, we never break a, we have certain rules that never get broken. And then all of a sudden you see over a 10-year period of time that the rules are broken, you have a new respect for what she's doing.
When you started and you started to work, I mean, I was reading today that you kind of had in your head that, okay, well, this is the UK Kardashians. This is the closest thing in America. It's going to be pop culture. It's going to be the E! Channel. But it's nothing like that. Explain that to us, because I still think in my head, this is pop culture, not to disrespect it, but pop culture trash. This is just people, like for the tabloids and for the E! Channel and for everything in between. But it's for that. But it's much more to you.
It is much more. And you'll have those royalists who believe that. You'll also have the haters who think it's ridiculous. I'm never going to watch anything royal. But when you take a deeper look at it, and you try, in my case, the kid from Chicago who could be somewhat objective, because I knew nothing.
Right.
I knew nothing about this except except what I learned in history. And you start looking at the official schedule and you start seeing that Prince Charles and Princess Anne, his sister, and the Queen and Prince Philip, that they're doing anywhere between 400 and 600 engagements a year. That's like three engagements a day without taking too much time off. So you'll read in People magazine about the vacations that they might have gone on. You won't read about that with the Queen, but you'll read about that with William and with Harry. But you don't see the other side of the life that they have of service, which the Queen started. And remember, not only is it service in showing up to these chicken dinners, but everything equates their patronages, their charities that they are responsible for, it all equates to money and it all equates to millions of pounds. So when they're involved in a particular charity, there's money that gets attached to that. They're so raising money.
It's a life of service. So so to hear you say it, that that's really what, if you're in the royal family, it obviously comes with, you know, royalness, if you will, but well, but it's a life of service.
So it started with the king, with the queen. I think it was fairly traumatic that her uncle abdicated. Her father, King George, got thrown into being king. Probably the combination of cigarettes and the World War ended his life at 56, and she found out at a very, very young age, in your 20s, I'm going to be the queen. So she went, she goes to the coronation, as you would expect her to do, the official start of her reign, and she makes and she takes an oath in front of God in her eyes that the most important thing in the world is what she has to do to fulfill her obligations of duty to the UK. And she's lived her life that way, above family, above anything else.
Wow.
And for doing that for, you know, she's been on the throne for 65, 66 years. That's not, you know, that's not some minor commitment. And you, when you think of Prince Charles, and he will say, not in a complaining way, he'll say, what people can criticize, but what they don't realize is because of my commitment, I know exactly what I'm going to be doing for the next 3 years every single day. I don't think you and I would like a life that we, no, that we knew exactly what we had to be doing every right day.
Fred Weintraub is here. We're talking about the royal wedding, which is this weekend, and really about the royals as Fred covers them. He lives in Chicago and Houston and in London, and he's really become a royal correspondent for the city of Chicago. All right, Fred, we'll take a break here. We'll come back, and let's talk about this royal wedding. Why does this one differ than the others before it? Fred Weintraub on The Download. Stay with us. Fred Weintraub's here. We're talking about the royal wedding this weekend. Prince Harry, Meghan Markle.
The extent of which I know, Fred. I just threw it all out there. I got nothing else to add.
You know, it is interesting as you talk about the royal family, what we may not know about them sitting here in Chicago and only really paying attention to the pop culture value. You think about the kids, and this wedding in particular is one that is very unique, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. Why?
It's unique because, first of all, he's probably the most popular of all the royals. He's marrying a woman who's divorced. He's marrying a woman who is biracial. He's marrying a woman who's had her own career. Those are all things that the royal family is not used to. And so the Queen, the way, you know, we did a story on the Jam yesterday. We taped a story on the Jam yesterday talking about how important is afternoon tea. And I said to my colleagues, it's really important because on October 17th, Meghan and Harry went to Buckingham Palace in a darkened car with windows blackened out so no one would see them. And they squeaked in as tight to the Queen's entrance to Buckingham Palace as they could. So even some of the senior staff did not know that they were in the building. They were going upstairs to have tea with Queen Elizabeth. And what Harry was really doing was asking permission to marry Meghan. If the Queen was having a bad day, if the Queen said, no, you're not going to do that, if any of those things were in place, this royal wedding would not have happened.
Well, it would. You would just look back at the royal history and you would assume that there would be a lot of question to all of the things that are firsts, meaning, you know, they want streamlined, they want it a certain way. That's just, you know, when you talk about royals and what the expectations are. So what is it about Queen Elizabeth where she's cool with all these things being a first? And we see this not only with Prince Harry, but we see it with Prince William as well. There seems to be a changing of the guards. See what I did there? in how the royals are perceiving themselves.
Because at 9, she's made some mistakes along the way, as anyone would. One of the mistakes being when Harry and William's mother, Princess Diana, was killed, it was perceived in the UK that the Queen was not overly sympathetic. She stayed at Balmoral, where the boys were. She did not come to London straight away. Now, her reason for it, which sounds logical and is probably true, is because she wanted to protect her two grandsons. And she thought the way to protect them was to keep them there,
keep
to
them
not have them in the spotlight of London. It kind of backfired. It probably backfired that the royal family did not give Diana the attention that she needed to learn to become a proper royal. You know, to get the 101 tutorial. That didn't happen with Kate. That's not happening with Meghan. When the press crosses over the line with Kate when they were first going out, and now when the press has crossed over the line first with Meghan and now with Meghan and her dad, Harry comes out in a formal way, either by sending a letter or probably by sending a letter saying, you know what,
you need to
back up. Give the person I love some degree of
what's
respect.
The relationship like? What's the relationship with the royals and the press? Because it seems like if you look at the American press and what's considered our royalty, which is political, it's not good. So what is the relationship with the royals? Have they figured out a way that they coexist?
Yeah, I think that I think in some ways they've figured out a way to better coexist versus the political climate in America where there's not very much coexistence, because Queen Elizabeth at 92 was cool, was hip enough to know, I got to figure out how to make the monarchy survive, which means making William survive, making Harry survive. So she became more open. The reason this wedding is so important is because you are seeing, and it was in the Wall Street Journal today, that you're seeing the new age of royalness with Harry and Meghan being allowed to break all the rules. They don't want gifts for their wedding. They want to include their charities. Meghan will probably give a speech at one of the parties on a Saturday night. That was unheard of before. All kind, you know, minor things to major things. William and Harry are now talking about mental illness, as is Kate, and they're forming this group that will be, in addition to their love of animals and conservation in Africa, mental health is a huge issue for them, in part because they were so crushed by the death of their mother. They both have come out over the last year and said, we kept it all pent in. We never told anybody that how hurtful it was and how painful it was. And that's not the way you become mentally healthy. And by Harry coming out and saying, I had to go see a counselor. Well, no royal would ever admit that they had to go see a counselor like a regular person who has a trauma in their life. And decides, I better deal with this trauma. It was the first time that he came out and did something like that.
Now, you're seeing with Prince William and Prince Harry, a changing of the guard, if you will, like I said. But, you know, they're in line, or at least William is.
William's
in line for, or you know, Prince Charles would be the next king, but he's 70 years old, so that, you know, William would be the next in line. It's one thing as princes to be chilling out and hanging out with Kanye and having fun and living life and changing the way the royal family is, but when they move up the ladder and they get to more levels of formality and importance in the monarch, will that change? I mean, they're going to get more formal. They're going to get more, you know, big boy tie.
I think that they will. I think that William will definitely, when he has an opportunity, become king. But you got to remember, you know, Charles will probably be king. He won't be as king as long as Elizabeth was queen. But he wants to serve in part so he gives William an opportunity to have a life before he becomes king. Will William, will Harry have to, will they be less out there? Probably, but it won't be hoity-toity, we can't say anything. They are clearly the future. Hmm. Whether they talk about mental illness or any of those kinds of things, they're doing it because they saw their mother doing it. They know if the monarchy is to survive, they better do those kind of things. They better figure out social media. They better figure out how do we have a royal channel because we've got to communicate with people. We can't be, you know, 20 years ago, the queen would never go over and shake hands with people. Now she'll go over and say hello to the people. That wouldn't happen 20 years ago.
All right, last thing. What should we be, for me, I'm going to watch on Sunday. What do I got to be looking for? What is the one thing that I should be looking for in a wedding, a royal wedding that is interesting, unique, and royal?
Well, I mean, nobody does pomp better than the British. So you will see some military types of thing. But this is really a family wedding. It is not a state affair. But you will see two people that I think are really in love with each other that are bringing their friends and their family together. The surprise that you will see, other than the stuff like what dresses she's wearing and all that kind of stuff, is the thing that will that could steal the show for both of them is the Prince and Princess of Cuteness, which is Prince George, 5 years old, and Princess Charlotte. If Charlotte turns around and waves to the camera, Meghan's going to have less than a fantastic day because the cuteness factor is going to come out.
Oh, Lord. Fred Weintraub is in studio. He works for WCIU. He's a contributor to the morning show, The Jam. He also covers the royals. He's sort of our royalty correspondent here in the city of Chicago. Fred, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Wednesday night.
That's right. It's time for the Swap Meet sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam is here at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. He joins us every Wednesday night so we can find out if your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk is worth anything.
Yep.
Usually it is. I was surprised.
Yep.
Usually you'll have something that's like the coolest thing in the world, and you'll be like, it's $5.
$5, yep.
And then you'll be like, I've got this piece of plastic, and you're like, that's a $250 piece of plastic. Right. That's just how it works.
That's why we're here.
That's right. 312-981-7200. Queue up now so we can get to it. Greg, good to see you, bud.
Good to be here.
So, you know, as we've been talking about all winter and into the spring, that when we get to this time of year, it's time to roll.
It's on.
It's game on. Game Wolf's time. Is open. Yep. Here we go. You've got the garage sales, estate sales. Are we seeing it popping?
It's going. I found a $6 pinball wizard belt buckle. Sold that for about $50 this week.
What?
So that was cool. And that was at Rosemont at Wolf's there. So that was good. And finding all kinds of stuff there. And I just advise people, if they want to find the really good stuff, get there early to, you know, Wolf. So you can get there as early as 2 a.m. If you want to shop with a flashlight, you can get there. But, I try to do 5:30, 6 in the morning, and I'm finding good stuff.
That's what you're rolling in. You're rolling to Wolf's at 5:30
in
the morning?
Yeah, about 5:40 I get there, yeah. So, and then, you know, I shop until about 7:30, and I go do my booth in Peloton at Wolf's. So works out. I got to be up early anyway for that, so why not?
Hey, I'm not judging being early bird.
We're not judging,
just,
right?
I just meant the stereotype of the picker is
it's
4 in the afternoon. I think I'll go see what's going on. Not with Greg Flam.
It's like a golf center display.
Yeah, right.
Golfing
right.
at night.
Right. All right, so what'd you bring in today?
Oh, bread and butter stuff. First off, 1978 Tomy Digital Derby Auto Raceway game.
Nice.
Now, I would play this thing, but it's so loud, and it's just amazing that this is what we would spend hours on playing.
What is it? Can you turn it?
It goes like that, and then you got to steer, and then when you hit the other car, you get... I'll try to hit one now.
Yeah, you got to purposely hit one.
Yeah, so... And this is what we would spend hours on, and now it's like on a timer, so it's going to be noisy. I'll try to hide it. Anyway... And
it's good. That's called ambiance.
Right. There we go.
Yeah.
We'll go with French. That. The cool find was I found a set of 5 Doctor Who posters.
Ooh, nice.
And it was for a 1986 book release. I'm going to turn this thing off with the battery here. Isn't that funny? So yeah, so these set of five Doctor Who posters, and it was for a book release in 1986, and very rare. So they could be worth about $50 each. So you're looking at about $250 here, and so that's cool.
That's awesome.
Yep. And then the funny thing I found was this Al Capone proprietor ashtray from the 70s. And
it's just big block.
I've heard of these. I've never been able to find one. It's not worth a lot, maybe $20, but it's Chicago history. So
yeah, essentially,
you know, conversation,
a tchotchke piece, right. A tourist piece of Al Capone.
Yep,
because of course, as we know, he was around in the '60s, not the '70s.
Right,
did I get that right.
But yeah, but they got the ashtray
right?
out.
Pete, I get that right.
Sixties, right? Yeah, right.
It was 65, I think. 65
now you're gonna light them up. You're gonna light up the phone
for Al Capone. I wasn't really paying attention to the Al Capone tour, but
yeah.
Think it was the late 60s. All right.
Be patient around on the phone.
All right, 312-981-7200. We've got, again, so here's how we're going to play. We've got the calls and the texts that come in. If you have something that you have been holding on to, memorabilia, collectibles, Greg can tell you what it's worth, which is great. And then there's also the brag part of this, where I'll give you a Lou Malnati's pizza if you got the best brag of the night. If you can come through with something, you're like, I'm not necessarily ready to sell this, or I got this hanging on my wall, but guess what I got? I already know what it's worth. It's worth, it's priceless.
Right.
If you got one of those and you want to brag and you think you got the best, then you're going to get a free pizza out of it. You get a free meal out of bragging about what's in your foyer, your foyer. Yep.
Bring it.
312-981-7200. It's a swap meet. Stay with us. All right. King John Williams will pay the Steve Cochran Show a visit tomorrow at 9:10 a.m. How fitting to have a king in studio ahead of the royal wedding. Have I mentioned? I haven't even mentioned tonight that I am going to be sitting in tomorrow on Steve Cochran as well. They've got a lot of... thanks for the clap. Thank you. they have a lot of people coming through. I know Nick's on in the morning. I know John's on. I'm coming. I think they're doing... they're getting ready for the Walk of Fame stuff, which is on Friday. So they're doing a lot of crossover kind of stuff where people are in. So I know that there's a big thing on Friday, but I'm going to be sitting in because the White Sox are tomorrow and Friday. I'll be sitting in on the Cochran Show both on Thursday and Friday. So that is a turnaround, Rob.
Boom. You can do it.
I know I can do it.
I'll listen.
And you know what I'm working on?
You've done it.
I'll bring it up next time we're on. I'm working on a new breakfast.
Oh.
The rolled oats, an overnight rolled oats. You heard of this?
No.
It's essentially a...
You're oatmeal. Not really selling it well right now.
No, though. It's oatmeal. It's like it's kind of like the rolled oats oatmeal that you get, like almost like a Quaker Oats.
Yeah.
But you put it like in a mason jar or something with milk and like banana, and then you do it overnight. And it wakes up and it kind of like sogs up all the milk and it almost cooked it, but it's cold, if that makes sense. Like cereal.
Yeah, we've had these before.
Are they good?
And there's nothing worse than getting a bad one. You know, because you put it in and you see it and it looks good because it's cold. And like, oh yeah, I'm going to just dig a spoon in this. This is going to be delicious. Uh-oh. And then you're like, it's kind of bland. Yeah.
No, but that's what I'm thinking about because... I always have an issue with breakfast in the morning when you got to get up and be there so early, especially on a show like this. So I got the rolled oats. My wife was like, "You should do overnight oats."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Oh, I'm going to do that when I get home. I'm going to do that, put it all together.
We'll perfect it."
Yeah, well, we're going to try it. No, I'm going to try it cold. I'm cold turkey.
You could do like a Jimmy Dean in the microwave.
Right.
I could do that too. Yeah. I don't have that. I have to make a stop at the Jewel. Right. I don't know. Problems. It's a Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Greg Flam is here at DuPage Picker. It's time for the swap meets. I was just telling you some of the things I mentioned this on the show, Greg, that I finally got to my bin.
Right.
I was hoping for a bunch of great... I mean, we were teasing this out in Crystal Lake when we were at Duke's. Mm-hmm. And he came out, and I was trying to get my dad to bring the bin. Then he finally brought the bin, and I was all excited, but I hadn't. I was telling Pete, I was like, I don't really want to open it. And I opened it up, and all it really was old report cards, me getting C pluses. You know, I was like, I'm like, why do I need this?
I know that feeling.
Yeah, and then there was, like, you know, Justin's not applying himself kind of garbage from fake news teachers. And as I had to tell my son, was really loving it. Hello, Dad. You're not applying yourself. All right, calm down. But there was a WGN, and they put it in there, but it was a WGN Cubs radio bumper sticker right. that probably was from the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And that was really the only thing to pull out of. There was a yearbook, my freshman yearbook,
yep.
and it was all signed in the bubbly letters by all the freshman girls that I went to school with. And it all started, there was a ton of them, and it was all girls. No dudes signed my yearbook. It was all girls. And they all started with, even though you're totally annoying, have a good summer. Like, it was like all of the variation of that throughout. And oh my, did the family get a kick out of that. Yeah. It was brought out at Mother's Day. It was nice. Brought out, like, you want to sit to all the other family members. You're like, you want to read this yearbook.
What I'd like to know is how many girls signed, like if they had Cindy with an I, did they sign the dot or a heart?
Yeah, you know, I think it was all doubt. I wasn't getting much heart out of it.
Yeah, okay.
I kept telling him, I'm like, it was a bit. It was a bit. These girls were doing bits. Mm-hmm. I wasn't annoying.
Yeah.
So what is a bumper sticker, Chicago WGN bumper sticker go for?
About 15, including shipping, yeah, from the 80s. I've sold a few of them.
Nice. All right.
Did they have the pinstripes on it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
Wow. Yeah. See, look at this. I am actually that plus the
the Jordan.
Yeah,
you're on a roll.
Yeah, I'm on a roll.
I think you need to pursue more of the bin and more of your
I know. I still have two bins I got to get through. So
yeah. Sometimes when I'm not finding stuff, I just go through my storage locker and it's like I pick myself. You know, it's like I pick what I've collected and I've totally forgotten about for the last 2 years. And I'm like, okay, this is cool. I totally forgot about
this. Yeah.
When you're not finding anything out there.
What about photos of various assortments of facial hair? In like 10, 15 years ago, where I was just going with a goatee.
You're on your own.
Then maybe I had like one where it was more beard than mustache.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yes.
That's not worth
a little
anything?
Personal. Yeah.
Okay. 847 says, I got a 5-inch metal shell ashtray. It's dated 1944, and it's made of solid brass. Hmm. It's from the U.S. Navy, they believe. But a 1944 ashtray, there's a picture of it.
Wow.
It looks very 1944-ish. It looks just kind of like a copper bowl. Hmm. But a 5-inch metal shell ashtray. Do ashtrays go for... Are they a big deal?
They do. I'm trying to think. Like, sometimes they'll be the lighter and ashtray sets. Those are kind of cool. That one you're speaking of, I've seen a few of the brass, like Navy or war ashtrays, and they could be like $50 to $100.
Really?
Yeah. And then sometimes they'll do folk art with the ashtrays so from like, there. Yeah. So, like the one I'm coming up now for $39, they put a bullet in the middle of the ashtray, like pointing up. So there's different
things. Yeah, this one just looks like the one they sent in the picture. It just kind of looks like it's a standard, but...
Yeah.
All right, there you
go. But yeah.
All right. Let's see here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Also, and this will be the second ashtray. We get a run on ashtrays.
Right.
That's what happens on the swap meet. We'll get a run.
Right. But that's okay. It's better than signed baseball.
Are there is there a holy grail when it comes to ashtrays?
Ashtrays.
Is there like one where you're like, if you've got the Rush 2112 ashtray, that one's worth $500.
It would be probably like $200 if they made one. You know, not so much. They're usually in the $50 to $100. And what's cool is some people are making trays out of old vinyl. You know, like if the Beatles record was so scratched up, people will have these molds where they'll mold them into candy dishes or ashtrays. Yeah. You know, that's something I come across. But yeah, ashtrays, I'm sure there's some that are worth a few
like
hundred.
Yeah, the big ones, right? Let's go to Mike. Mike, what do you want to brag about, Mike?
Hey, I've got a Stan Hack autograph.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. I don't know how rare it is, but I mean,
who is Stan Hack?
Great. Who is Stan Hack?
Yeah,
who's the third baseman for the Chicago Cubs in the 20s?
All right, okay.
All right.
What do you mean,
I just loved it. I'm supposed to know that.
Right.
I don't know that.
Oh,
Pete would know that. I don't know.
30s and 40s.
30s and 40s.
I think it was Tinker, Evers to Chance, and Hack was on third.
That's not how it goes. It goes Tinker, Evers, a Chance. I never heard that. And Hack was on third part of the
improv. Third. Well, anyway.
Is that the second part of the old right. folk tune?
Unplugged version.
Oh, Stan Hat was on there. Never did Stan.
He's working it, man. He wants that pizza.
So
that's a good one. I like it.
He had a restaurant called the Landmark Restaurant. I forget what town it was in. It was between Rockford and Chicago.
Okay.
And after my first visit to Wrigley Field in 1970 against the San Francisco Giants, we stopped at this restaurant, and my dad said, "Hey, Stan, hey, I'm signing some from some." So he signed one of his
that's awesome.
At his restaurant.
Oh, right, okay.
I don't know if it's valuable or not, but I know he spelled my last name wrong.
Oh, yeah. I could tell you right. Well, what do you got on Stan? Does he show up? Does Stan Hack show up?
Yeah, he's in the $40 to $50 range for like a photo. Card is in the $50 range from 1935.
What about a placemat from the Landmark restaurant?
A placemat. Well, as Justin was going to say, if he signed it to you personally, it devalues a little bit.
Yeah. Right.
If he would have just signed his name, it'd be worth a little bit more. So a placemat from his restaurant, though, would probably still be in the $40 to $60 range, I would think.
Yeah. I also love that Stan Hack had figured out, I mean, it is your duty as a third baseman for the Chicago Cubs to have a restaurant. You can't.
Hell yeah.
Why waste that opportunity? You know, like I'm still mad at Ron Say. Where's Say's?
Right.
Say's would have been awesome on Ontario. Yeah, right.
Okay. I could never look forward to Ron Center Pizza.
Right. There you go.
Right.
Nice.
All right. Good stuff, Mike. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
That was good. Mike's good. I like that. All right. 312-981-7200. What did you say?
No, it was a good story.
Yeah.
You know?
Swap meet. We'll take a break. We'll get Rob Martier's news, and we'll do the second half. We got some texts and calls coming in, so stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here we are.
That's right. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam can be found at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. 312-981-7200. It's the second half of the Swap Meet. We've got something you want to be evaluated, some memorabilia, some collectibles, some junk, just something you want to brag about. This is the segment for you. Pizza's on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Pizza's on the line. John, what do you want to brag about, bud?
Good evening. I got something that it's a Pinocchio. It's a marionette puppet from Pelham. Pelham Puppets.
Okay. Yep. Got it.
Made in England.
Pelham.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's all you got to say. Is it life size? Is it like the kind of thing that if you put sprinkle some dust on there, it can turn into a real boy?
It's in a box. I got the original box, and it's about 14 inches.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, boy, a real boy.
Well, I think you just read your listing on eBay. I think I found your listing. You're asking about $100 for it, it looks like. Is that your listing?
Because
that's just how you described it. Pelham Antique Pinocchio Puppet with Box from England. 1960, 62, and it's listed for about $100 shipped.
That's a new segment we're doing called Is This Your Listing?
Yeah,
Oh, no, I'm not listing it, though.
Okay, well, then someone else has one, so they're asking $100.
They're asking for $100, so that at least puts you in the ballpark. I like that one a lot, though.
Yep.
Yeah, honestly, I'm not listing it. It's very interesting. It's from my childhood, so... Yeah, it hasn't been out of the box for about 40 years.
Yeah, and some have sold for 50 to 60, just so you're aware. In the box, they've sold for about 60.
All right, well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
If I were him, I would take it out of the box, and I would just go sit in a park bench and put him on my knee. And be like, someday you'll be a real boy.
All right.
You know, it's funny because I went to see, I went to Disneyland, whatever it was, for spring break, and they had the Pinocchio ride. And for the first time, I've done that a couple times in my life, and I've been on the ride. It's awesome. It's one of the best where it's just it's the old 50s style where it's just a car that's on a track and it kind of goes through. It's awesome. But it's so rudimentary in the stories they're telling in those fables or those stories, the Disney story, mm-hmm. even in the way it breaks out. The Pinocchio storyline is essentially, don't be a bad kid. You'll turn into a donkey. If you eat sugar and do bad stuff.
To this day, I still sing the Jiminy Cricket song, I'm No Fool.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe Pete can pull that up.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. All right, Sandy. Sandy, you're up. What do you want to brag about, Sandy?
Oh, I don't want to brag it, but speaking of ashtrays, I have a lot from Vegas from the 70s and 80s
awesome.
With the names of them.
Yeah, that's a brag. What do you mean you don't want to brag? That's the best brag ever. What do you got?
I know, but you know what? I stole them, so, you know.
Which ones are you talking about? What do you got?
The names on them and the old Caesars, you know, with the embossed head and all that. I was just wondering, should I hang on to them or get rid of them?
I think you hang on to them, right?
Yeah, you're probably better off hanging on to them.
You got a circus in there?
Pardon?
You got a circus in there?
No circus.
Yeah, if
but,
they're
they don't have them anymore. They don't have the names on them or anything that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of places did away with the ashtrays, of course. But you're probably better off holding on to them. They're about 15 to 25 for on most of them, and that's high end. Unless you have something really old, and normally the hotels that are no longer are the ones that go for higher money.
Right. I was there when they blew up the Sands, and I got the Sands mug. And
awesome.
And two more questions.
Yep.
The Star Wars Trilogy VHS tapes, the set, box set.
Yeah, those are going for about $200.
What?
Yep.
Oh,
no
man.
Way.
Yeah.
No
way.
Yeah, I sold one myself about 8 months ago.
Can it be totally beat up? And
obviously, it should be. Yeah, it should be.
They're in a box and everything, and the Godfather box set too, VHS.
Yeah, that not as much as the Star Wars. I'm going to say
Star Wars $200.
$200 for the trilogy Star Wars.
What?
Wow. Yes. Okay.
And that's VHS too, which is crazy.
That seems so.
I still have my VHS. I'm sorry, I'm not getting rid of it.
Yeah, about 25 years from now, we're going to be missing our VHS players because everyone's dumping them and. It's going to be like.
Well, we paid like $600 when we first bought ours. That's how expensive they were back then.
Right, yeah, the top loaders, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, this one isn't a top loader. This is the second one we bought. The first one was a top loader. Yeah. I think we dumped that, though.
Yeah.
No, those are the ones you want to keep,
Thanks, you didn't Andy. Grab any chips
I can't believe
with the ashtrays, did you?
I'm going to have to tell my kids not to get rid of them then.
Did you grab any poker chips
chips from the casinos?
Yes, I got some chips.
Yeah,
I got some original keys.
There you go.
They used keys back then.
Yeah, I mean, if you do sell, you can, like, lot together some more hotels and get a little bit more money that way.
And the stirs, all the drink stirs.
Yeah, the stirs. Yeah, there's a whole swizzle community
with
out
the
there.
The names,
so,
yeah.
So good.
Yep, that's awesome. Right up my alley.
Thanks, Sandy.
Okay, bye-bye. Right.
Thanks.
I'm just annoyed because I had the trilogy, and I totally destroyed it. I mean, I had them outside the... I was actually watching them. I'm not one of these collectors who's going to keep it in the cellophane, but I would never think. I think everybody had that, right? Everybody had Jedi, Empire Strikes Back, and Star Wars, and VHS in that trilogy. You got it for a Christmas gift. Oh, thank you. Oh, yeah, Star Wars.
Yeah, it's one of the VHS that is doing well. Many of them are a quarter.
What about Beta, if you were a Beta guy?
Beta does better if it's still like... still sealed or even blank media Beta is doing pretty well.
Oh man, when I lived in Wonder Lake and we were old family, thinking of my grandma today, that we would go to the Village Market, which was on Wonder Lake Road, and we would go into the Village Market and they would have one wall that was mostly Beta with like one shelf for the VHS, and that's when I first saw the great movie Ice Pirates. Classic.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I do remember with my grandma one time that we were able to rent. My grandma was, she, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, she passed away yesterday.
Yeah.
And she would be the surrogate mom in the way that my mom was very, she was very hippie in her parenting, right? She was very like, we're doing wheat bread, that kind of stuff, right? Ugh. So you could, when you were at grandma's, it was, oh yeah, of course we eat Choco, Fruity Pebbles, Captain Crunch. Like, of course we do, Grandma. Just buy that.
Right.
But also, I remember I once convinced her to rent from the Village Market Revenge of the Nerds.
Mm.
Right? Now, there's a lot in that movie for how old I was, 10, 12 years old, that is not for 10 to 12 year olds. My poor grandma, when, they're putting the cameras in the dorm rooms and stuff like that. Was like, I remember she was like, you need to turn around. So I had to just turn around while the
Good memory. Story. Yeah.
All right, let's keep going here. Let's go to Rich. Rich, what do you got, Rich? What do you want to brag about?
Hey, I was just wondering what I've got the complete TV series of The Highlander on DVD, and the I think there's like three other Highlander movies up to the final one where it just basically ended. I was just wondering if they're worth anything.
Let me see for you.
They're all they're all in like a box set, I guess you'd call it. You know?
Yeah.
Let's see what's coming up here.
Highlander. Is that with Lorenzo Lamas? Is he in Highlander?
Oh man, I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know who's in.
Can't remember the guy's name off of the TV series.
Yeah, they're in the $200 to $300 range. It looks like recently, February, the Raven complete series of that one for $300. So, that's not
okay.
Bad.
All right. Yeah, my grandkid, my grandsons watch them once in a while, and they get freaked out because the only way the other they can kill each other is to chop off their heads.
But yeah.
See, there you go. So you're living the same thing.
Yeah, my daughter just doesn't quite think that's appropriate for, you know, 14 and 9-year olds. But hey, I'm a crazy grandpa, so
grandpa,
they got to learn
grandpa,
sometime.
It's 2018.
Right.
They've seen worse, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Game of Thrones, all that.
Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, sir. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
That's so true. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're playing Swap Meet. We'll take our last break here. We'll come back. We'll wrap up. We got John. Jill is on as well. Got some people on text. We'll get to everything, so stay with us. It's Swap Meet tonight, 312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman here with Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Let's go to Jill. Jill, what do you want to brag about, Jill?
Oh, hi. Now, mine's brand new. I collect the Funko Pops. I actually think I heard you saying you were getting your son one once.
Yeah. No, you know what we did? We went to the Comic-Con or the C2E2, and I was amazed at how many are there, and we were trying to find the Thanos one, because that was very specific, trying to find that one.
Right.
And then the chair, maybe?
Yeah.
And, yeah, well, it was really hard. So what do you got?
It's fun. Okay, so mine is the Funko Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
King Aragorn. Toys R Us exclusive. Not Barnes & Noble. I got Toys R Us, I think, not a knockoff, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. What was the character name again? I have the rest of it.
Oh, King Aragorn.
Okay.
So
you don't remember King Aragorn?
No, I'm sorry.
He's the kind of the bearded hunk.
He's Strider. Yeah, he's the one that becomes king.
He's the mysterious one. We're like, what's his deal? But he's really fighting for justice in Hobbits.
Yeah. He's like not really human. He's like,
he's a god of
Lives a little longer. You know, actually, speaking of, have you seen Infinity War? I am trying to prepare. I actually got on Solo tickets also, and I've never seen Star Wars. But I just watched Guardian of the Galaxy last night to prepare for. Have you seen Infinity War?
I have seen it. Yeah, I've seen it twice.
Well, the pop vinyl, you're looking $50 to $100, and most of the Lord of the Rings, any character are about $50 to $100.
Cool. Well, he's in his little protector in the closet, so I'll keep him safe.
Yeah, there
keep
you him. Go. That's good.
Bye, too.
All right, thank you, guys.
Awesome.
Have
Thanks,
a good night.
Jill.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just watched the Guardians of the Galaxy clip because there's a great clip from Thanos in Guardians where he goes, "Your politics bore me." And I don't know why that hasn't been used more in every conversation ever.
Right.
I'm going to start using it all the time. We're going to pull it as a drop. Your politics bore me.
Nice.
Let's go to John. John, what do you want to brag about, John? You there? Did I miss you? John?
No? Hello.
Hey, John. There he is. John, what do you want to brag about? What do you got tonight?
I have a Sears Model 872 antique sewing machine.
Ooh, cool.
Wow.
It's on a case, but it folds down into the stand.
Okay.
You can't see it, you know.
Okay, trying to find that for you.
All right.
110 volts, so I know it.
Yeah, and you said, what was the year on that again?
I think it's 1950, but the model number is 872.
Yeah, most of those are in the $60 to $100 range.
Oh, man, that's not enough.
I know, it's not. But the thing with that is they're so heavy, they're so hard to ship, and you know that's why they're so low. If you do sell it, obviously try OfferUp or Craigslist. You might get a little bit more.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, John. Right.
Thanks for calling.
You know what?
Yep.
I also have an invitation to Harold Washington's first inaugural ball and to his funeral.
What?
Oh, wow, both.
How'd you get that? You got invited?
Yes.
Wow.
Awesome. Well, tell us about that. Yeah, tell us. There might be a pizza on the line here right at the end, John. You got my attention.
Yeah, well, it's the formal invitation to the inaugural ball, his first one.
Mm-hmm.
And the ticket is for a funeral.
Wow. Where was the funeral?
Did you go?
Pardon?
Did you go?
No.
Oh. Hmm.
Why didn't you go?
Because I didn't want to see him in that condition.
Yeah.
Wait. I'm confused. This was for Yeah, I know, but for...
Oh, for the inaugural ball?
Yeah, for the inaugural ball. I'm not talking about the funeral.
Okay. My sisters went. I didn't go.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. Well, that's neat. Obviously, I'm not going to be able to find that to give you a value, but that's awesome.
I mean, think that's awesome. It is. I love it.
That's a great...
I can't believe you let your sisters go and you didn't go.
Why not?
Well, why would you want to skip it?
Right.
Hey, I value things. I'm a hoarder.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
You just want the ticket, let them go, and just say, bring back the invitation.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks for calling. All right.
I'm going to give the pizza to Sandy. Is that cool? She had all the chips from the the casinos in Vegas.
Yeah.
But she really got me on the VHS and then telling me all about VHS machines that she had in the top loader.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it to her just for the fun of it. And I came very close to giving it to Stan Heck. As well, but
yeah, that was a good story.
It was a good story, but we're gonna give it to
Sandy.
Sandy's gonna get it.
Awesome.
All right, awesome. Thank you, Greg. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to be here
at DuPage Picker, both at Facebook and Twitter. And you can find him at Wolf's on
Palatine, Saturday, Sunday, and then of course, Rosemont's open too.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.